to the panel today, to my right, Justice Dolfino, and to my left is Justice McCoy, and I'm Judge Bill Meyer, and I'm presiding judge today. So we can start and do that. Start to call the cases, please. Thank you. You're ready, ma'am.
May it please the court, and good afternoon. My name is Marianne Auld, and along with David Keltner, I represent the appellant in this case, BNSF Railway Company. This is a case that James Phillips brought against BNSF in April of 2007, alleging violations of the Federal Employers Liability Act, the FELA, and the Locomotive Inspection Act, the LIA. According to Mr. Phillips, whole body vibration from the operation of locomotives caused him to develop a degenerative spinal disorder. And further, Mr. Phillips alleged that BNSF's locomotive seats failed to protect him from the vibrational forces on the locomotives. Before trial, BNSF filed two separate motions for summary judgment. The first was based on Mr. Phillips' failure to bring his lawsuit within 3 years of the date on which the cause of action accrued, as the FELA requires. The second motion for summary judgment was based on Mr. Phillips' failure to connect his claim, to relate that claim, to a specific locomotive as the LIA requires. The trial court denied both motions and the case proceeded to trial, where after a verdict was rendered in favor of Mr. Phillips, the judge entered a judgment against BNSF. BNSF respectfully asked this court to reverse the judgment against it and to render judgment in BNSF's favor for the following reasons. First, the evidence conclusively establishes that Mr. Phillips failed to file his suit within 3 years of the date on which his cause of action accrued. In fact, Mr. Phillips knew critical facts regarding both his injury and the work-related cause of his injury some 9 years before he actually filed suit.
Your theory of accrual under the FELA means
that if he has knowledge of critical facts relevant to the injury and to the work-related cause of his injury, that he has an affirmative duty to investigate, and that begins the accrual of the cause of action. Yes, Your Honor. The second reason that the court should reverse and enter judgment in BNSF's favor, no evidence supports the jury's finding that BNSF violated the LIA. Third, the trial court erred in failing to submit to the jury the issue of Mr. Phillips's contributory negligence. And finally, the trial court erred in making rulings regarding causation. As we'll see, the court erroneously kept out relevant evidence of causation that BNSF offered, and the court found that some evidence did constitute evidence when, in fact, what Mr. Phillips presented as causation was no evidence. Turning to the first issue, the judgment should be reversed because Mr. Phillips did not timely file his FELA and LIA claims. As a result, those claims never should have been submitted to the jury, and this court should render judgment for BNSF. From the outset, it's important to recognize that the FELA does not contain a traditional statute of limitations that requires a defendant to raise it by way of affirmative defense. Rather, the FELA places upon the claimant, upon Mr. Phillips, as a condition precedent to recovery, in other words, as an element of the plaintiff's claim, the burden to allege and prove that he filed suit within 3 years from the date on which the cause of action accrued. Therefore, while courts and parties routinely refer to the limitations provision as a statute of limitations, that's not entirely accurate. We do that for ease of reference, but what we have here really is not a statute of limitations so much as it is this condition precedent to recovery that is an element of the plaintiff's claim. And here, Mr. Phillips failed to present legally sufficient evidence of his compliance with the FELA. As this court held in Billman, an FELA cause of action accrues when the claimant possesses critical facts concerning both his injury and its underlying cause, as I was just saying to Justice McCoy. Importantly, this is an inquiry notice standard. In other words, for a cause of action to accrue, it is not necessary that the claimant know the precise name of the disease that's causing his symptoms. It's not necessary that the plaintiff have a specific diagnosis from a physician. And it's not necessary that the plaintiff possess actual knowledge of the cause of his symptoms. Nor is it necessary, as this court said in Billman, that the plaintiff even be aware that the defendant is blameworthy. Instead, accrual of the cause of action is deferred only until a plaintiff's symptoms manifest themselves to a degree and for a duration of time that is sufficient to put a reasonable person under similar circumstances, in this case a reasonable locomotive engineer, on notice that he suffers from some injury and he knows, or in the exercise of reasonable diligence, he should have known that the injury is likely work-related. In this case, the evidence conclusively establishes that Mr. Phillips possessed those critical facts sufficient to put him on notice both of the injury and its work-related cause long before April 13, 2004. Since the cause of action accrued long before April 13, 2004, that means that when he actually filed suit on April 13th of 2007, the filing was untimely. Let's talk first about the critical facts that he was aware of regarding his injury. These facts, at the very least, put him on notice of the injury prior to April 13th of 2004. In 1998, Mr. Phillips went to the chiropractor for the first time for tenderness and soreness up and down his back. At the time, his symptoms included low back pain, neck pain, stiffness, cramps or backache, tingling or numbness in his hands, legs, and feet. Also in 1998, Mr. Phillips told his chiropractor that he had suffered from chronic back pain for years and that his symptoms were constant in any position when he was awake. After Mr. Phillips saw that chiropractor for the first time in 1998, so constant and persisting were his symptoms that he continued to see the chiropractor on a regular basis. In fact, from 1998 till 2005, Mr. Phillips saw the chiropractor some 34 times for these very same symptoms. In 2003, after 5 years of treatment, Mr. Phillips' chiropractor ordered an MRI in order to investigate the cause further of Mr. Phillips' continued symptoms, including back pain and pain down the left leg to the left foot. The radiologist that did the MRI read the MRI and in 2003 diagnosed Mr. Phillips with spondylolisthesis, the very same degenerative condition for which he sued BNSF some 4 years later. Given this evidence, certainly Mr. Phillips was on notice of his injury long before April 13th of 2004. But not only did he have notice of the injury, Mr. Phillips also either knew or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have known of the work-related cause of his injury. Importantly, again here, the law does not require actual knowledge of the work-related cause of the injury. Instead, the plaintiff only needs to have a reason to know of a potential cause of the injury. When he does have that reason to know, an affirmative duty to investigate the cause of the injury is triggered. The Seventh Circuit's opinion in Tolston versus National Railroad Passenger Corporation is instructive here. In that case, a railroad worker experienced knee injuries beginning in the 1970s and going into the 1980s. Throughout the 1980s, the pain in her knees increased. And by 1989, she was receiving regular treatment and regular medication for extreme pain in her right knee. She didn't file suit, however, until 1995 against her employer. In determining that the suit was untimely under the FELA's 3-year limitations provision, the Seventh Circuit said that from an objective viewpoint, these facts, the extreme pain, the fact that she was receiving regular treatment and medication by 1989, were enough to require some investigation into the potential causes of her condition. While the court accepted her representation that she never asked anyone what actually was causing her condition, the court held that just didn't matter. The facts here were sufficient to make the cause of action accrue by 1989, and therefore her filing in 1995, some 6 years later, was untimely. Well, there was that as well, but that certainly isn't the only evidence here, Your Honor. Well, at that time, in fact, he was experiencing those symptoms because he was continuing to see the chiropractor for those symptoms. Right. There were some different symptoms. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Issue with the statement made in counsel.
Correct. Right. Here, Mr. Phillips did, in fact, possess the critical facts regarding the work-related cause of his injury. In 1997, the year before he visited the chiropractor for the very first time, Mr. Phillips began to hear discussion at union meetings about the subject of whole body vibration, and he heard accusations that alleged rough riding locomotives could cause injury, could hurt workers' backs. After attending those meetings, Mr. Phillips sought medical treatment for the very same condition he now complains of, and importantly, he attributed that condition to his work. In 1998, when he went to see the chiropractor, on the chiropractor patient's intake form, in response to the question, what activities aggravate this condition? Mr. Phillips, in his own handwriting, responded, rough riding railroad engines. Mr. Phillips did not list any other activities that would have aggravated his condition. From that point on, Mr. Phillips never wavered from the conclusion that his spinal injury was work-related. For example, in 2005, when he went to see a neurologist finally, he was asked to identify on the patient intake form anything else that you think may be significant. The only thing he wrote was railroad engineer 32 years into career of rough riding engines. Despite that diagnosis of diabetes, Justice McCoy, that you mentioned, he did not say anything about that when he went to the neurologist. Instead, he was continuing to attribute his injury to these alleged rough riding engines. Well, the injury and its work-related cause. The fact that in this point he was connecting and drawing that connection between the injury and his work on locomotives for BNSF. Even at the time of trial, Mr. Phillips continued to associate his spinal condition with his work. On cross-examination, he testified that there really was no other explanation for his spinal condition. Work was the only thing that he could relate to that condition. So the bottom line here is that the evidence conclusively establishes that from his very first visit to the chiropractor in 1998, Mr. Phillips did draw that connection between his spinal injury and his work as a locomotive engineer. And we have proof of that fact in his very own handwriting. He wrote that himself. He knew critical facts, therefore, indicating the work-related cause of his injury prior to April 13th of 2004. He simply did not exercise reasonable diligence to investigate those facts further. Because he did not satisfy his burden to establish that he complied with the FALA by filing suit within 3 years of the date on which his cause of action accrued, which was the first element of his cause of action under the FALA, Mr. Phillips did not meet his burden under the statute, and this court, BNSF respectfully requests, should enter a take-nothing judgment in favor of BNSF. Correct. He did say that. Those aren't necessarily inconsistent at that point. He may not have believed that it caused it necessarily at that point, but he certainly did draw a connection between the injury, the reason he was there at the chiropractor, and his work, because he did say in his own handwriting that the situation was aggravated by these alleged rough riding engines. And here what we have is a situation where all we're talking about is inquiry notice. We just have to have facts that are sufficient to put him on notice so that he will investigate further. And all of that is here. Clearly, he had an injury. From the time of 1998, he recognized these pains, these symptoms, these very same symptoms that in 1998 he had all the way through until he actually went to trial And so that over a long period of time, he had the very same symptoms indicating the very same injury. And certainly, he was already drawing a connection between his pain and his work by 1998. That continued all along. And so that was sufficient to put him on notice so that he had to investigate affirmatively that connection. That's what the FELA requires, and he failed to do that here. This court also should reverse the trial court's judgment because the jury's finding that BNSF violated the LIA is not supported by legally sufficient evidence. Specifically, Mr. Phillips failed to allege and prove that BNSF was liable for a violation of the LIA relative to a specific locomotive. There are logs and there are records that would indicate which trains he was on, and there was never any indication because he never complained about any of the locomotives on which he was working, and therefore he never came back and attempted to connect his LIA claim to any of those locomotives as well. Dr. Johanning rode on the same track to look at the track conditions to determine what those conditions were, and certainly BNSF also, as we'll talk about in a little bit, it did a geometry car video doing the same thing to measure the geometry of the track. That was not allowed to be introduced as evidence. Judge Lowe kept that out, but both of them did that, sure. According to the language of the LIA,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but your
okay.
Time is up.
Thank you.
Appreciate your presentation.
May it please the court. My name is Sean Cox, and I represent the appellee, James Phillips. I'd like to first address the statute of limitations argument. The standard when you're dealing with a cumulative injury, latent injury, is not the same as when you have a traumatic injury. That at that time you are able to identify exactly what the source of an injury is and that it actually occurred. With a cumulative or latent injury that occurs over a period of 30 years of cumulative impact from Rough Riding railroads, the standard under Childs v. Halsecker in the Texas Supreme Court is that you have to show some objective verification of the injury and its connection to the work. And that's what's lacking in this case. Mere subjective belief, as a matter of law, according to Childs v. Halsecker, is insufficient to start accrual. And that's all that's here. All they've been able to point to is the mere subjective belief in 1998 that the muscle pain that Mr. Phillips was feeling was related to his work. The objective verification of the spondylolysis and that it was caused by his work did not appear until July of 2005 when Dr. Bannister diagnosed him. Now, it's true, you don't have to have an actual diagnosis to start accrual, but you must have some kind of objective verification, something that is more than just mere subjective belief. And that's what's lacking here. We have some aches and pains in 1998 that came and went over a period of years. In 2005, and in the current state, we have a plaintiff who has metal plates and pins inserted into his back to provide some kind of stability, and constant pain. Now, you've got an extreme of two different things, muscle spasms, which he thought might be related to work, and the pain that he's experiencing now. In the interim, he's diagnosed, when he goes to a doctor and he complains of some of these pains, he's diagnosed and told that it's related to diabetes or hypertension, not that it's related to spondylolisthesis or any degenerative disc disorder at all. In fact, and the comments in the brief regarding Dr. Cruz's examination where he was diagnosed with diabetes, that's lifted directly from the report that he was not reporting any kind of shoulder, neck pain, back pain, and that there were no skeletal or musculoskeletal abnormalities, I believe is what the, how it's phrased. So when investigation was done, when Mr. Phillips did investigate the claim, he was told it wasn't work-related, it was diabetes. And a key factor here is that this is a jury verdict on the statute of limitations. There was a fact issue that was raised, according to the court, that the court felt. It went to the jury, and the jury returned a unanimous verdict that he did not know or should not have known that he had a work-related injury back outside the period of limitations. Now, they have to prove conclusively the opposite of that to overcome the jury's verdict here. And what's strange is they actually submitted expert testimony from their expert, Dr. Spengler, who declares that these injuries that he's suffering from right now are not work-related. How can you have an expert and present testimony that an injury is not work-related and yet still claim to have conclusively proven that Mr. Phillips knew or should have known that his injury was work-related? The two facts simply can't coexist. So not only do we have evidence that at least raised a fact question from Mr. Phillips, who testified that he did not know until sometime in 2005 that he had a work-related injury. But we also have their own expert testimony saying that it's not a work-related injury. So the fact question that was submitted to the jury has not been overcome with conclusive evidence. They have not conclusively shown as a matter of law that no reasonable juror could have found that he knew or should have known. Now, regarding the LIA and the necessity of having identifying specific locomotive, the problem, Justice McCoy, you identified is this is over a period of 30 years with trains that don't even exist any longer. There is no requirement in the LIA that you identify a specific locomotive, nothing in the plain language. And the U.S. Supreme Court case, the central case for FILA and the LIA, Urey v. Thompson, which actually addressed the Boiler Inspection Act, but is the precursor to the Locomotive Inspection Act, it does not require any identification of a specific locomotive. That case is very interesting because it's very similar to here. It was a silicosis case. And a railroad worker was exposed to silica or sand in the railroad cars over a period of years. And because of a problem of failure to maintain the railroad cars so that they would not expose him to silica, that was sufficient for this U.S. Supreme Court to allow that case to go forward under the Boiler Inspection Act, which is the same as the Locomotive Inspection Act. They did not require any specificity of that he had to point to a specific locomotive that was the problem or identify or make a complaint about a particular locomotive. All that was needed is that he identify the problem that he experienced with locomotives over 30 years. And that's what happened here. Mr. Phillips identified that the rough riding train cars and the seats which he was required to sit on that provided no shock absorption at all, that was the defect, the problem with the trains that caused him the problem, that is covered by the LIA. That was the problem. Just like the silica being released in Urey v. Thompson, so was the vibration that was caused by the improper seat. And this covers not just the toadstool seats that he sat on in the first half of his career, but all of the seats, as identified by Dr. Kress, that all of the seats he sat on, even those that were supposed to provide better protection, were still unreasonable. So we did identify a specific problem with the locomotives, even if it wasn't identifying locomotive 39 on this particular track. That kind of specificity is not required in the LIA. And the LIA, which is designed to provide relief to injured workers, the policy behind that even would not require that kind of specificity. It doesn't show up in the actual language of the statute, and U.S. Supreme Court precedent would counsel otherwise.
John,
yes, Your Honor.
Could you focus just a little bit on question number 6? Because that question is inquiring about knowledge. Should he have did he know or should he have known before April 13, 2004 of both the alleged injury and its cause? And then we have proof that I see in the record of conditions for which he did seek treatment. Counsel just identified 34 visits to chiropractors in 1998. Now, is that, would you address whether that of itself is knowledge of the alleged injury, or was the injury that in your circumstances of proof and pleading an injury that occurred after April 13, 2004?
It would appear that the injury actually did occur after April 13th, or at least that was when he first would become aware of that. Those initial pains, I guess, is what you would say. There's no connection that those were related to his spondylosis that he complains of now. That they're two entirely separate items. And again, under Charles V. Halsecker, all he had was a subjective belief that maybe it was work-related. And that, the Supreme Court says, as a matter of law, is insufficient to start accrual. He had to have some objective verification. He never got that. He never had that connection made until 2005.
And then 2005, knowledge was determined by whether through the examination that he had in the MRI that was conducted in 2005.
I believe so. It was Dr. Bannister, who I believe was the surgeon. There were two doctors. There was one surgeon and one that was an orthopedist, I guess, in general. That actually diagnosed it and said this is work-related, diagnosed what he had, what the problem was that he had, and that his pain was related to that. Now, it's interesting, there was a radiologist who identified spondylosis in MRI in 2003. But again, there's no connection. For one thing, there's no evidence that was information was ever communicated to Mr. Phillips. But beyond that, there's no connection that the spondylosis was causing the pain of which he was complaining at the time, or that the spondylosis was related to his work, which, according to their own expert, was not. That it is not. Even today, that is not a work-related injury.
Well, that argument, aren't you, is simply asserting that there was, in fact, sufficient facts for the trial judge to decide that I'm giving something judgment. How are we going to submit this issue to the jury?
That is right there. There is, I mean, of course, I mean, there was a fact question, and that was sufficient. Once we got to the jury, and the jury found that Mr. Phillips did not know and should not have known that he had a work-related injury outside the limitations period, then they had the burden to conclusively prove the opposite of that, and they presented affirmative testimony rebutting the conclusion they're claiming should be found by this court. Now, an interesting aspect of this case is that it is a FELA case, and yet it's been brought in Texas State Court, and there's been a dispute over what the causation standard should be. Well, the causation standard is undeniably what is set out in FELA, which is, as recognized by this court just last year and reaffirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court, is a featherweight standard. It's the any part test, that if the negligence of the employer contributes in any part, no matter how slight, to the injury, that is sufficient for liability. It has set a very low standard. Now, they claim that the standard should be that you have to first satisfy the expert standard under Texas, requiring showing two epidemiology studies and showing a doubling of the risk. And you have to satisfy that before you can have any evidence of causation. Even though that's not what's required under FELA. There's a conflict right here between this high standard and this intentionally low standard. And that can't coexist. It completely undermines the congressional intent behind behind FELA. Now, they've cited two cases in Texas which have applied the Texas standards requiring this heightened level for experts to be able to testify. And the Abraham case just assumes that that's the standard. There's no discussion of the federal standard, possibly the causation standard affecting the admissibility of expert testimony. But what's really interesting is the Navarro case, which came out in 2002 out of San Antonio. That case feels that they have to apply the Texas standard, even in the face of the Eighth Circuit in the Hines case, which we cited, which says that the lower causation standard affects the admissibility of expert testimony because you can't have that conflict. It can't exist. But the Navarro court felt that they had no precedent they could rely on in Texas that would allow them to apply this lower standard and not apply the expert requirements. Well, the Supreme Court of Texas provided that precedent in 2008 in In Re Global Santa Fe. And in that case, it was a silica case again. And it's the it addressed Chapter 90's requirement of an expert report. And Chapter 90 required additional things to be shown in an expert report than would have been required under federal law or even under Daubert and federal expert requirements. The court held that those extra provisions were preempted by federal law. Now, this was actually in a Jones Act case, but it's the same causation standard in Jones Act and FELA. They recognize you can't have that conflict between a lower causation standard and an expert standard that is elevated requires additional materials. They also, in a very interesting quote, they say that Chapter 90 cannot be interpreted in a manner that would change or alter or elevate the standard under for Jones Act case for causation. That's exactly what they're asking this court here to do today, is to raise the standard required for the evidence beyond above what is required by FELA, which is just a featherweight standard. The Supreme Court has provided the precedent that will permit this court to only apply permit the expert testimony to show at least some evidence of causation. Now, one thing I like to say is regarding contributory negligence, because I did mention that earlier, the one point I'd like to make on that is, in the reply brief and in their opening brief, they still have yet to point to one piece of causation evidence showing that any contributory negligence on the part of Mr. Phillips contributed, caused any of his injuries. In fact, they present that affirmative evidence from their own expert that this was not a work-related injury. And regarding the genetics argument, they've been talking about that genetics evidence should have been admitted into the case. Well, sorry, I see my time has expired. The eggshell skull plaintiff rule would prohibit that, and that's exactly what their attorney at trial was trying to submit that evidence for, was in order to show a genetic predisposition to injury. That's what the purpose was. It was stated to the court at trial. And that's exactly what's prohibited by the Otis Funkmeyer case regarding the eggshell plant. Thank you, Your Honor.
With respect to the statute of limitations, counsel for Mr. Phillips comes powerfully close to saying that they have to have actual knowledge of the injury, what its cause is, objective verification of that fact, and that just is inconsistent with what the law says. We don't need that. What we need is, according to this court's precedent in Billman, knowledge of critical facts sufficient to put him on notice of his injury and its work-related cause. It is an inquiry notice standard, and that is what has to be demonstrated. Here, evidence conclusively establishes that he had those critical facts, he possessed those critical facts with respect to his injury and its work-related cause, sufficient to begin the running of the statute of limitations way back before April 13th of 2004. With respect to diabetes, it simply is not true that Mr. Phillips relied on Dr. Cruz's 2004 diabetes diagnosis. When Mr. Phillips consulted a neurologist in 2005, as I mentioned before, less than a year after that diabetes diagnosis, he neglected to mention that such a diagnosis had been made. Instead, when talking about with the neurologist the kinds of pains and the kinds of symptoms that he had been experiencing, all he said in terms of the cause of those or what would be significant for the neurologist to understand and appreciate was that he was a railroad engineer 32 years into a career of rough riding engines. In his brief, at pages 9 and 11, Mr. Phillips concedes that his diabetes diagnosis had little to do with spinal injury symptoms other than the numbness in his extremities. It just isn't true that he relied on that. With respect to this featherweight standard from McBride and causation, that standard, to the extent that it is the standard from McBride, only applies to factual sufficiency challenges to causation evidence. BNSF is not making a factual sufficiency challenge to the causation evidence in this case. Instead, BNSF argues in its briefs that there is legally insufficient evidence of causation to support a finding in Mr. Phillips' favor. It's a legal sufficiency challenge. And the cases that we've cited, Abraham, Navarro, here talk in terms of legal sufficiency, the admissibility of evidence, and make the point very clearly and very persuasively that that is a Texas standard when we're talking about the admissibility of expert evidence. That evidence that was not reliable and was not admissible cannot constitute any evidence of causation. And since it's a legal sufficiency challenge, we're not worried about the featherweight standard of McBride. Going back briefly to the statute of limitations argument, because I want to address Mr. Cox's statement that we somehow are inconsistent. BNSF has not been inconsistent. For the purpose of the statute of limitations, a defendant like BNSF takes the case as the plaintiff brings it, whether the defendant believes it to be true or not. And years ago, Mr. Phillips had knowledge of critical facts sufficient to put him on inquiry notice as to what he believed causes injury. That started the statute of limitations running. He then also had the burden to prove causation, and certainly BNSF's experts took the position that he had not done that. But looking at his knowledge through his eyes sufficient to start the running of the statute of limitations and what ultimately may have caused his spinal condition, those are two separate things, and BNSF certainly has not taken an inconsistent position. With respect to contributory negligence, we do link Mr. Phillips's failures to his injuries. Certainly if he had red tagged, if he had ever made any kind of a complaint, BNSF would have been in the position to address and remedy the defects that Mr. Phillips now claims exists on the locomotives. That never happened. That was negligence on Mr. Phillips's part, and that should have been submitted to the jury. With respect to the evidence that the trial court kept out, that BNSF offered, such as the genetics testimony, the testimony of co-workers, the geometry car video, that was all evidence that was kept out that really kept BNSF from being able to play on a level playing field. The trial court allowed Mr. Phillips to introduce all kinds of evidence that would generally perhaps suggest a connection between his activities on the railroad and his injury. Given that fact, certainly BNSF should have been able to fully explore by cross-examination other causes, such as genetics. There had been no genetic testing, but Mr. Phillips had the opportunity to say, I'm going to have some genetic testing and rule that out. He did not do that. Under this court's precedent in Faust, he had the responsibility to eliminate other plausible sources of his injury, and he did not do that. BNSF respectfully requests that the court reverse and render the judgment in BNSF's favor.
Thank you for your argument, counsel. Judge